Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and by GoDaddy.com. As a Film Spotting listener, enter code FILM3, that's FILM3, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Coming up on this week's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music by Enon.
Plus, our Screwball Comedies Marathon continues with a Cary Grant double feature, The Awful Truth and Bringing Up Baby, and we'll count down this week's top five drug movies. But first, can you feel it coming in the air tonight? Michael Mann brings Crockett and Tubbs to the big screen in Miami Vice.
Are you afraid of violence?
We get down if the play calls for it, bud.
We're here for business.
That's right.
We can close each other's eyes right now real fast.
Then ain't nobody gonna make no money.
This is Detective Crockett, Miami-Dade PD.
We got him.
No one has ever tread before where we are now. We're seeing their operations from the inside.
Your agency cannot know how they do whatever it is they do.
The very existence of the new film version of Miami Vice is an exercise in contradictions. On the one side, you've got the name, Miami Vice. Adam, can we cue the theme music here?
Yeah, let's go ahead. All right. We'll bring it up here.
A television show whose music, fashion, and visual style helped define the 1980s. The name alone feeds an expectation that the movie will deliver a nostalgic rush. On the other side, you've got Michael Mann. Okay, I think we can stop the music here. The executive producer of the original TV series, who has become perhaps the most serious director working in Hollywood. If anyone can crush your dreams of nostalgia, it's Mann. Other than the location, the leads, and a plot involving a South American drug kingpin, little else in Mann's film is reminiscent of the series. Miami narcotics detective Sonny Crockett and Ricardo Tubbs are back, here played by Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx, and the plot has them going undercover to act as runners for a powerful international drug cartel. Complications arise when Farrell falls for one of the bad guys, Gong Li's Isabella, our drug kingpin's mistress and business partner. Adam, I don't know if you and I were really old enough to be called fans of the original series, but we were certainly influenced by it. We were too young to grow Don Johnson's 5 o'clock shadow. Actually, in fact,
we're
I'm not sure I can
young.
Still pull it off. But as you mentioned on last Friday's show, you used to strap on your dad's holster, play Miami Vice with a friend,
sure.
And I know whenever I slipped on my boat shoes without the socks, I was invoking Sonny Crockett. So I know I went into Mann's Miami Vice with some expectations that I would remember what it was like to watch the original series. But I also knew that Mann would make me earn my nostalgia trip if he even let me have one at all. How about you? Did Miami Vice satisfy either expectation, good nostalgia, or good Michael Mann film?
Well, it is interesting. You mentioned this contradiction, and this film is a big contradiction. I went in, too, with those same expectations for a Miami Vice movie. You kind of expect it. When you first hear about it, they're going to make a Miami Vice movie. You cue the Jan Hammer theme song, you know,
right.
And you do think it's going to have to be, even if Michael Mann's directing it, somewhat cheesy.
Yeah.
You know, you think about the cheesy theme song. You think about the pastel suits and no socks, as you mentioned. Even though the show, for its time, really was pretty serious and groundbreaking, but you assume it's going to be kind of an update that's going to be really flashy and is maybe going to be kind of a newer take on Bad Boys, is I think how a lot of people maybe expected it. Or, at the very least, something with a really ironic tone. He's going to have to acknowledge
somehow the source material.
The source material, or maybe cheesiness, depending on your perspective there, that he's going to have to wink at you in some
way. Then again, this is Michael Mann.
But then this is Michael Mann. You know, then now I feel really stupid that I even thought that, because Michael Mann is not really a funny guy.
No, has he ever? I mean, really, I'm trying to think of a moment in any of his films that's funny.
He's maybe even too serious. He has no interest in making a buddy comedy, and he really has no interest in being ironic or clever.
No.
And so why we thought that, I'm not exactly sure. And what he's done here, he's pretty much taken the Miami Vice name and the characters and cast off everything else that we've talked about that we associate with the series, all that flashiness, and just focused on what actually made the series so interesting, which is really kind of the mood it evoked, the palpable tension and this visceral quality. I know that we overuse that term visceral a lot on the show, but until I come up with a better word, I'm going to keep saying
it,
because it is kind of this idea that it just focuses on this sort of animalistic quality and this intensity. And you get that here. And Sam, you forwarded me an email from YouTube. You sent me this link. And other people have too, and I've seen it a million times. This clip, you get to watch the last kind of 3 minutes, or this 3-minute segment from the pilot of Miami Vice. And you have In the Air Tonight playing with Phil Collins, and Crockett and Tubbs are heading to a bye, and they've got their guns, and it's intense. It is. It's awesome.
It gives me chills thinking about it, honestly. It's just, and I've said to you too, there's no way I actually saw the original pilot episode of Miami Vice in 85 or whenever it was. But when I watched that, it had the feeling, it reminded me of the experience of watching that.
Right.
Of watching the show, of just the feeling of cool and detachment.
That's exactly right, cool. And I have to say that this is not, Miami Vice is not a great film. It's marred at times by a bad screenplay, and I mean both the writing and the structure of it. The plot here has a lot of holes and makes little sense in moments, but I did like the movie, and it's better than Collateral, I think, and it was a return in some ways to what I expected from Michael Mann, and it is a return to, as you said, that just coolness of the original series and watching that in the pilot. So,
yeah, I mean, I have to say, it really just bored me. I wasn't interested in it at all. And I mean, for me, the big problem comes down to the relationship between Crockett and Tubbs. I mean, I don't dislike either Ferrell or Fox. I think they're both fine actors in their own right. But I never believed that they were partners. I mean, at no point, and I think, you know, a man starts his film, and God, we were talking about this not long ago, just like, I wish directors would chop off the first 20 minutes of exposition and just get us into the action.
Well, he does.
Well, he certainly does. We get right into the middle. We're launched right into the middle of a club scene. Something's going on. Something's going down. We're not sure what. And in fact, we never actually find out.
I'm not sure if we watched it 20 times, you'd figure it out.
Yeah, that's not really the point. It's as if, you know, we're watching the next episode in a series that actually didn't exist, because this is a totally new imagining of Miami Vice. But really, you know, and I can admire that and appreciate that fact of bringing us into the action, but I never bought, there's never a time when we really, for me anyway, I got the satisfaction of these two guys being buddies. To go back again, briefly, to that 3-minute scene that you can get on YouTube of the original series. There's a look that Philip Michael Thomas gives Don Johnson, because he knows, like, Don Johnson is like, and if you watch the full clip, you realize, like, he's got something else on his mind. Mm-hmm. He gives, Don Johnson a really sympathetic look, and it's really kind of moving. I haven't seen the show, I don't know what it's referring to, but it's kind of like, you know, there's a connection there. You know, he's watching out for his buddy. And this movie is so caught up. Michael Mann's new Miami Vice is so caught up in these secondary relationships. Farrell's relationship with Gong Li and Jamie Foxx's with his wife. And we'll get into both those relationships, I'm sure, later. But it's like the missing element here is their relationship, their reliance on each other, their ability to take care of each other and rely on each other's strengths. And there are a couple scenes where, they have to out-talk the bad guys. But I didn't even necessarily buy that stuff. I found it too cool for its own good, but I really just didn't find any connection between the two. There weren't enough scenes of them really bonding. And again, I don't want a conventional buddy action film. I know Mann isn't going to give me that, but at the same time, I left the film without any sense that they had any relationship at all.
No, I agree with you that it is not a movie that you could put in a male bonding top
five,
as we recently did on our show. We talked about those movies, and you do expect that going in. You expect that this could be a kind of male bonding movie, and it's not, because the fact is, you're right, once Gong Li is introduced, her character Isabella, he goes off with her and kind of disappears for a little while, and all of a sudden, there's no Crockett and Tubbs, and you're kind of left thinking, what's going on here?
In fact, there's not a lot of Tubbs.
No, there isn't, really.
I mean, there's a lot
of... Which is kind of the way it was in the original series,
though. Yeah, that's true, but I mean, I really miss Jamie Foxx. I was like, why? What is he even doing?
Neither actor is given much to do.
Really, that's true.
That's fair to say, but with all that said, for me, there was enough. You talk about that look that Tubbs gives him in the pilot. Well, I saw enough of those looks that I bought their relationship. I bought that they were partners and looking out for each other. And I kind of like the fact that when he disappears with Gong Li, Tubbs lets him go and just knows that he knows what he's doing. He's going to accept that he must know what he's
Ferrell
doing.
Well, Ferrell even says, like, I know what I'm doing.
Trust me here. So they go away, and you notice, I mean, again, it could have been cut any number of ways, and you could have approached this a number of different ways, but Tubbs never really calls him this whole time he's gone. He's gone for like days, right?
Days away in Havana, getting the best mojito in the world.
I mean, Sam, you're gone for 2 hours. I'm calling you like five times on the cell phone, right? But here, Tubbs is gone. They're in the middle of all this stuff. He doesn't call him till he's on his way back.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they just kind of know each other. I trust that they have this relationship, that they know each other and they trust each other and they've got each other's backs. And I thought that was there. So for me, it worked. Okay. And for me, those other side kind of storylines did work with those characters. I'm not sure. Is that actually supposed to be Tubbs's wife? Trudy?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I mean,
it's
never
a couple. Clearly.
Right, there are definitely a couple. They're living together. Yeah. They're in love. It's a long-term relationship where Farrell is the animal after the one-night stand in Cuba or whatever it
true.
Is.
True, but I want to say, Sam, just before you jump in, that it is true. I walked out of this movie, and I could tell that other than this is the second time I've seen a Michael Mann movie in a row where people did actually clap at moments of violence. When people got shot, the audience actually cheered. The good part here, unlike my Times Square experience with Collateral, is at least this time they weren't cheering when a cop got shot. And a good cop, nevertheless. I mean, you know, it's not even a bad cop.
Oh, my God. I'm realizing which scene you're referring
to. Yeah, but here, people did, again, applaud. But with that said, I could tell the vibe around me and hearing people saying things during the movie and on the way out that people were not into this film. And on the way out, I heard all these people behind me giving their reviews.
Those,
and people were saying... That was so slow. It was just so slow, and it just didn't go anywhere. It had no point. That's what I kept hearing. And you know what? Well, one man's slow is another man's deliberate.
Well, usually that's me, right?
You know what?
I mean, usually I'm defending the deliberateness of films.
Yeah, some people call it slow. For me, it was deliberately paced, and I have to say I was pretty much mesmerized by it and never bored. I mean, yes, it doesn't really have a point. True. Do you come away with it knowing anything more about drug running or undercover work? I didn't, but... He is trying to tell kind of these human stories within these larger contexts, and for some reason it worked. Yeah. It connected with me.
It's kind of surprising, only because for me, this film doesn't, and I'm not saying it's what it was going after, but it had no attachment to the real world. In fact, it has like all the components of a fantasy.
It's very self-contained, which I liked about it,
actually. But for me, it's like it has all the components of a fantasy without any of the fun. Everyone is so serious.
No fun.
There's no fun to be had here, really.
Which is fun in its own way, Sam.
Okay.
You
can be caught up in the tone. I can totally imagine someone being caught up in the tone, the serious tone, like the hushed seriousness. Everybody talks like a badass. Everyone is a badass. Now Tubbs can fly a plane. Exciting for him. That's something he couldn't do, Philip Michael Thomas. Obviously, maybe
less talented.
Scared of flying like Mr. T in the A-Team. So for me, I can see like he creates a tone with music and the dark visuals. He's using like a digital camera the bulk of this film is filmed at night, it seems.
Uh-huh.
And I just wasn't taken with it because I wasn't having any fun. And I didn't buy the relationship between Farrell and Gong Li because you can't ignore that it's a contrivance. It's just a plot contrivance to give like Crockett some personal stakes in this whole undercover operation, because Tubbs has his, you know, personal stakes with his relationship, and you know his wife is going to get in trouble at some point, and she does, and that is the most interesting scene in the film
for me.
It's like it actually has the kind of stakes for me where it's personal stakes at risk, and it was fun, and you get the badass line before the bad guy gets shot, and there's like a satisfaction in that where the rest of the film doesn't have. And I thought the sense of cool was really forced. I just never bought into it.
Okay, I did buy into it. And again, I want to say that this is not a perfect film. I'm not going to give this 4 or 5 stars. I am saying that the plot of this film has some big-time problems. I mean, that beginning scene, you really do have no clue what's going on for the first 15 or 20 minutes of this film, even though, like I said to you, I do agree. I wrote down, too, in my notes that I kind of like being rushed into it, though.
Yeah, I did, too.
But the Gong Li, Isabella, and Sunny subplot, I don't really buy that they would flaunt their relationship like they do. They would be smarter than that, which kind of what
ends
up setting
up a
whole
like there is a risk
film.
There.
Yeah, no,
you know what
you're right. It's kind of contrived, that is. Also, a lot is made of this subplot of there's a leak. There's a mole in one of the government agencies.
Right.
A lot's made of it. You get a scene later where they do something specifically to try to address who the leak is, and then it's never addressed again, and it's never resolved. And then at the end, there's a shootout at the end, let's just say, and Sonny's placement and behavior in it and Gong Li's behavior in it make no sense at all. The movie needs them to be there and to act a certain way, and it doesn't work. But with that said, I did buy their relationship because Gong Li, I think, is so good. Obviously, we've liked her in other films, but here I really thought she delivered every line with conviction, despite the fact that she's speaking English and Spanish, two languages that are not her own,
Chinese
and that supposedly she had trouble with. And I love the fact that, like you get with a Michael Mann film, a gritty, real, grainy film like this, she's not perfect. She's not a Bond girl.
No,
you look
true.
At her, I mean, she's beautiful, yes, but she has blemishes and imperfections and yet is stunning despite those imperfections or maybe even because of them. I just thought that was great. And I did like, obviously, the visual look of it. This is back to the Michael Mann I wanted to see more controlled than what we saw in Collateral, where that grainy look and that hyper-intense, I mean, the close-ups are unbelievably intense. I mean, you have to be someone really comfortable with yourself as an actor to be in this film, because you're going to see every
under the
blemish.
Microscope,
like I said, you're literally almost like under a microscope, and yet for me, that intimacy and that intensity does work. And so I loved Gong Li in this film. I love the visual look of it. And even, you know what, the difference between the original Miami Vice and this one, and I like this contrast, is unlike in the original in the TV series, when you get the scenes, they're on a boat, on a speedboat, and they're going somewhere, and you get the music coming in, and it's fun. You're right, it's fun.
Yeah, right.
Here, when they're on a speedboat and they're going somewhere, it's not fun. But for me, it worked. It kept with the tone of the overall film, where you've got characters speeding off to Havana, and instead all it does is really express the isolation that they feel and the loneliness of it.
Right.
They're out in the middle of nowhere. It should be this, hey, we're going 200 miles an hour on this great, expensive boat. And instead it's like, well, we're kind of getting away from the crappiness of the world.
Yeah, but who are you and what are we doing?
I mean, and those things really did work for me.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like to sort of talk about the griminess of this movie, and I think it's an accurate way to describe it, and it absolutely plays against the glamour that we're used to with the original film. But for me, again, it's another example of the film just being less fun. I'm not saying he should have embraced or I expected Mann to embrace the glamour of Miami necessarily, but it just took the fun out of it. And so I wasn't engaged. And so if that's the case, I mean, it's not being replaced by the fact that I'm really engaged in the characters or really engaged in the plot. In fact, I didn't really care that they had to take down the bad guys. These guys seem like, I miss the flamboyant sadism of these Colombian drug lords that would come up in the Miami Vice.
See, you wanted bad
I'm not saying I wanted all these things. It sounds like I really wanted or expected a cheesy action picture, but the fact is these guys just were kind of businessmen, and they were completely, you know, disassociated with any reality I know.
Right.
So the danger of them selling drugs, apparently, or, you know, getting drugs from Trinidad or Cuba or Colombia, there was no sense of it affecting or being relevant to my life. And I didn't expect, although I do think that Mann has an interest in like exploring international drug trade and really what does international crime look like in this day and age, and he has a lot of fun with the lingo and all that stuff, but that didn't make it more interesting to me. I mean, I didn't really feel like I was learning anything, and I also didn't think it actually contributed to my enjoyment or my understanding of these characters.
Okay, well, the lack of fun for me, that lack of artifice and that kind of self-contained universe, that made it actually fun in its own way for me. I was really into this movie the whole time, I have to say.
All right, well, if you've seen Miami Vice and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
Have you seen pictures of Michael Mann recently? He actually is starting to look like Werner Herzog.
Oh, really?
They look a little bit alike if you take away the glasses.
I always imagine him kind of looking like Tom Cruise in Collateral, actually. But
he actually is starting to look like Werner Herzog, and apparently the making of this film
it was Herzogian.
Was a Herzogian experience.
It's true.
Anyway,
with murders right, in foreign countries, you're right.
Go find two
great
pictures
point.
Of
him. And you the obsession of it,
The jungle. You even get jungle shots.
True.
You get big boats on a river.
Well, this was my point about the film. It's like the trouble with bringing a TV series to the big screen, it's like, well, we've got to make it bigger than anything that would ever be on TV. And I felt like that's all the other locations did, and like, you know, just the use of technology, and again, like, okay, we're in Colombia and we're in Brazil and all this stuff, and it's like it seemed a distraction from the fact that they didn't really have a story. And I'm like, if this was just Miami Vice, like in Miami, I think we would have been much more aware of how, like, you know, how unthorough this whole thing was thought out.
Okay, I think it would have been more conventionally entertaining, but not necessarily a better
that's
film.
That's what I want, conventional entertainment.
That's you. After the break, I hope to make it across the border. I hope to see my friend and shake his hand. Listeners, correct our top 5 male bonding mistakes next in listener feedback, plus your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater. But first, some recent audio feedback.
Hey, Sam and Adam, this is Victor from TankRiot.com. I love your podcast, and I'm very much looking forward to the anime marathon. As a matter of fact, we focused on Tank Riot number 12 exclusively on Studio Ghibli and the works of Hayao Miyazaki and Isaiah Takahata. I love their works, and I hope at least 3 of their films appear on your anime marathon. If not, hey, I look forward to following along, and you can always do a Studio Ghibli marathon all of its own, because I don't think the studio has put out a bad film in their entire existence. Good luck, and thank you so much for all the great, great reviews. And I look forward to Snakes on a Plane.
Fireflies.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and this week's PureFlix DVD giveaway, Sam, we're giving away Some Like It Hot, the two-disc collector's edition. We don't have the winner yet from PureFlix, but when you find this show on the filmspotting.net site, we will post the winner in the notes for this show.
That's right. Sign up for a PureFlix account now, and you'll be entered to win V for Vendetta, a special two-disc edition out on DVD this week, along with A Fish Called Wanda Deluxe Edition and a Best Sellers Edition of The Graduate, probably, what, the 30th edition of The Graduate?
At least. Safe to say A Fish Called Wanda is the one
we'd rather own. But I know there's a lot of people that like V for Vendetta out there, although it is a decidedly mediocre film.
Yes. Okay. We're giving away a mediocre film. Why are we doing that,
Sam?
I
have no idea.
Okay.
All right, well, just go to PureFlix.com/filmspotting or visit filmspotting.net to activate your PureFlix account.
Also, we want to thank some donors this week, people who were so generous, and we've got a lot of generous people to thank who went to filmspotting.net, clicked on one of the PayPal links, and we didn't get to this on last week's show, so we have to actually make up for lost time here and thank some people. And as we mentioned on that last show, we now have the option of, if you just want to throw a few bucks our way in a one-time donation, that's great, or if you want to subscribe and kick us $2 a month, we really appreciate that. You can do that now as well, and some people did.
Yeah, we do appreciate everyone that donates, and please be patient here. We do have a lot of donors this week, and thanks to everybody that has donated. Okay, we've got Eric, the Devil of Cartagena, Aaron R., Cheap Wine and Blue Roses, Aaron M., the Handlebar Gumshoe, Terry, the Kiev Switchblade, Robert, the Billy Club Assassin, Nicholas, the Wise Man of Gibraltar, Kristen, the Ash Heap Flamingo, Josh, the Suede Blade, Egbert, Yellow Shirt, Dope Fiend, Paul, Paraguay's Most Wanted, and then a couple, like you said, $2 a month donors. We've got Alexander, 3-Alarm Autopsy, Roger, As the Monkey Flies, Joel, 12-Gauge Homecoming, Gordon, Cry of Hellhounds, Robin, Nightclub Cage Match, Donna, The Calm Before the Nihilism, and Derek, Scone Cold Tea Party. I was really getting down to the bottom of the barrel there, but please, thank you. Thank you, Derek, Scone Cold Tea Party. I spent the last 45 minutes just working on nicknames alone, and I do appreciate it. Thanks again to everyone that's
donated. That's tragic, though, Sam, that you did. Real quick, though, let's correct one thing. I believe it's Kirsten.
I'm sorry, Kirsten. Kirsten Ash Heap Flamingo.
Ash Heap Flamingo.
She rises from the ash heap like a phoenix, but instead she's a flamingo.
Nicely done.
It was a nod to Miami Vice.
Okay.
You know, the opening credits sequence.
I got it, Sam.
All right.
Well, again, we want to thank all of you who donated. Poll question, Sam, last week on the site, we asked you, which of these movies is definitely one to see before you die? And this was a list generated by Film 4, Channel 4 in the UK. Their list, Apocalypse Now,
picked at
Chinatown,
random, apparently, right.
Yeah, City of God, The Apartment, and Sexy Beast. And the results were,
and maybe no surprise, out on top at 49%, Apocalypse Now, followed by Chinatown, then City of God at 17%, then The Apartment at 8%, and Sexy Beast. Quite a surprise, but did get a few votes here.
I mean, we 3%. Like Sexy Beast.
Again, I don't want to, just the film you should see before you die.
It's kind of odd that it's in the top five.
It is.
That's what we're saying.
But it's just, throws a little monkey wrench in the works.
It does, but 3% of the vote. I guess I was a little surprised that actually City of God, I guess I shouldn't be because it's a very beloved film,
especially
by people,
younger people. A film we love.
Yeah, from our generation, but The Apartment is a classic. I'm surprised it wasn't higher on our list, but what did you vote for, Sam?
Yeah, I voted for Apocalypse Now. At the time I said, in terms of like cinematic visions, if you're going to see one of the great directors and his great cinematic visions, maybe not even his best, certainly. I mean, we're talking about the man that directed The Godfather films, but Apocalypse Now is certainly one to see.
Okay, and I really think that Apocalypse Now was my first choice, but when it comes down to it, if I'm just walking by someone on the street and they say, hey, should I see Apocalypse Now or Chinatown? I can go home and watch I'm actually going to recommend going to see Chinatown.
You're going to insist they start their Faye Dunaway marathon.
I am. And find their Faye Dunaway love, Sam.
Well,
this week's poll question.
Won't be alone anymore. All right.
We've got, which summer comedy are you most excited about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got Accepted, Woody Allen's Scoop, Snakes on a Plane, a future camp classic, and then, of course, Talladega Nights, which opens this weekend.
And Sam, your vote goes to?
My vote goes to, come on, please, everyone, if you've been paying any attention
Accepted.
At all. It's Accepted. It is Talladega Nights, the Ballad of Ricky Bobby. I was just thinking last night the fact that it's called the Ballad of Ricky Bobby. I've just been overlooking that for a while.
Right.
The comedy does not stop.
No.
It begins and
it
does not end with the title. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's my vote too, of course. And I guess I'm curious to see where our listeners fall. Are they really that excited about Snakes on a Plane versus Talladega Nights? Because I have to say, we've been kind of championing the call, Snakes on a Plane, since listeners started emailing us. But You know, I have to say that Chuck Klosterman recently wrote an article in Esquire that really summed up some of my latest feelings about Snakes
some
on
fears,
a Plane. I'm
rather.
Actually afraid now yeah. about seeing it and reviewing it. I'm not that interested in it. But also on this list, I put Scoop, Woody Allen's new film that came out limited this past week, just because I wanted to acknowledge how odd is it, Sam, that a new Woody Allen movie is coming out and we're not reviewing it.
But not right away. We will be.
Eventually,
we'll certainly
maybe,
get to it.
But like, it's not a priority.
Well, you know what I was thinking? This will be the third Woody Allen film we'll have reviewed in the history of film spotting slash cinecast.
In just over a year, three movies. It is amazing. But I guess the answer to that is, at least for me, is I was actually more interested in Miami Vice because Scoop looks bad.
It doesn't look great. Yeah, I have to admit. It just seems silly. But I was thinking, too, with Snakes on a Plane, it is a lot of fun to be in a theater when the preview plays. And again, the preview... Again, people are laughing at it, and there's a fun little buzz as people are like, oh, it's the Snakes on a Plane preview, and it looks absolutely ridiculous. But I was also read something about, whoever the studio, I think it might be 20th Century Fox that's releasing it. They're like, you know, we didn't really make a comedy. I'm not
of
sure people
not.
Are going to get what they expect, and of course they're not.
That's why they were going to call it Pacific Air Flight, you know, 121 or whatever.
They'd be better
and that's what I'm worried about, actually, is people are going into it expecting to laugh at it, and I don't know how actually funny it's going to be.
I do like how committed Jackson seems to be in his performance just in the trailer alone.
Right.
You know, he's like, you know, we've planned for every possible scenario, and I'm up against one that we haven't prepared for. Uh-huh. And he is dead serious, and I love it, and I think that might save it.
Okay, we'll see. We want to acknowledge the audio feedback we had there, a clip from Victor, who mentioned the animation marathon. And real quick, we just wanted to touch on this because we've been getting a ton of great feedback in our message boards and through email about this animation marathon.
Which is going to last 6 months if it's up to our listeners.
Exactly. Yeah. But after screwball comedies, after documentaries, we're going to get to an animation marathon. And we mentioned that it very well could end up being mostly an anime marathon. And just for the record, we're going to call it anime.
Anime.
Because
anime.
Chad Bowers from Funimation, this company that puts out anime discs. You've heard probably of some of their stuff. Full Metal Alchemist, Samurai 7, which you can see on the Independent Film Channel.
That's right.
Speed Grapher, Mr. Stain on Junk Alley. He sent us some DVDs. We really appreciate that, Chad, and also everyone at Funimation. He said, you know what? Yes, anime is the correct way, but everybody calls
anime.
And that's what we're going to call it. And in response to Victor's voicemail there, some of those movies, certainly, I don't know about Studio Ghibli, but the Miyazaki films, we're definitely going to get to. Right now, Sam, we don't have the list finalized, but Princess Mononoke is a film that's definitely going to be on the list, a Miyazaki film. We're also going to have Grave of the Fireflies for
definitely,
and Akira is a definite.
Yep.
But then we've got three others.
Maybe Ghost in the Shell, probably.
Maybe Ghost in the Shell. You know, we're looking at other Miyazaki films like Spirited Away, you know, Howl's Moving Castle, and we've got great lists from everyone, and again, we really do thank everyone who has contributed
to that. We'll be posting
that.
The final list soon for
pretty
people
soon,
to debate over.
If we get done fighting about it. Well, let's get to some Lady in the Water feedback, Sam, a movie we reviewed on last week's show, along
That's
with Clerks 2. We'll also be hearing some Clerks feedback. Why don't you get started?
Yeah, this one's from Dennis West, who writes, Adam and Sam, I saw Lady in the Water on my birthday, and I have to tell you, that was the worst birthday present ever. I have never had such an anxious movie-watching experience in my life. All through the movie, I was thinking about how this movie was made instead of how the story was engaging me by the plot. Suffice it to say, from the opening prologue, which totally took away any mystery about who she was, and on throughout the rest of the film, words like contrived and convoluted kept coming into my mind. The story seemed to meander along, hoping to be linked together by the reciting of a bedtime story that was, coincidentally, exactly what was occurring. Instead of finding an interesting way of showing us what was going on, M. Night resorted to telling us. That might have worked in a book, but not in a movie.
Okay, well, Dennis certainly shared our feelings, or at least my feelings. Sam, you'll get into yours a little bit more, maybe kind of laying out that you actually did give this movie 3 stars.
We've talked a bit about it. I think this works as a good metaphor for films that, like, maybe everything else has fallen off the car, but the car's still running on the rails, basically.
Yeah.
And
you
it's like, by
it.
The end, I was still sort of with it. If it didn't indeed work its magic on me, I never gave up on it.
The performances mainly held it together for you. Well, this one from Buck in Tacoma, Washington, he asks, okay, so am I the only person on the entire planet that enjoyed this movie? I'll admit that I went into the film an M. Night fan and wanted to like the film. It's far from perfect, but it is a great bedtime story. It's a children's tale and one that I enjoyed thoroughly. Maybe I was just able to go along for the ride, even if I was the only one on the train, but I found myself really enjoying my experience. I did roll my eyes when it dawned on me just how big a role M. Night's character played, and I long for Mrs. Howard to be more Cate Blanchett-like, but all over...
more ethereal.
Yeah, well, who wouldn't like every actress to be like that?
Right.
But overall, I liked the story. It was a fun time, and I'll be anxious to see the next M. Night film. So Buck, you know what? You weren't alone. We had this email too from Sam Field, who said, love the show, but for the first time, I find myself disagreeing with you. I think Lady in the Water is great. The acting is brilliant. The story is as good as Sixth Sense, and the directing is not half bad, though it has flaws. The beginning goes way too fast, Sam says. It still is a great movie that people should see.
All right. Well, and I will say, I mean, we spent the bulk of the show, granted, talking about the problems with the film, and I don't know if I got around to saying again, yes, I was still interested in the story and in the characters, and I think the movie is largely flawed, but I still would recommend that people see it once. I'm not going to see it again, but Giamatti's performance alone, I mean, we said it's one of the better performances we've seen this year, despite what he has to do.
Yeah, no, and I like Bryce Dallas Howard, too, and you know, we've got a great email here from Misael Soto in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, that I really want to get into, but in the interest of time and getting to some other topics, let's hold off on it, Sam, and either in this show or maybe the Dope Sheet or another show, but just we can get into Misael's a little bit
I think
more.
We can, but just to note that it's somebody that seemed to be frustrated with the idea that I could almost like a film, or it never quite came around to admitting that it worked for me. Mm-hmm. That's because it didn't entirely.
Yeah.
But I think I hope, and hopefully it came across what did work for me. And I did. I don't think we talked about this on the show last week. There was one scene in particular that reminded me about the excitement of storytelling and storytelling power, where you have a group of adults like crouched around the stall where Bryce Dallas Howard is sort of sitting. She's the Narf.
In the shower,
In the shower. And it's all these adults are trying to figure out their role in the story in terms of how are we going to get this magical creature home. And there's a palpable excitement as they try to piece together the puzzle that reminded me of what it was like, you know, being a kid and trying to solve a puzzle with a group of people. Yeah. And there was like, in that moment, the adults became children.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, I think that's what M. Night was after. And I don't think he was successful for the most part in the rest of it for me. But he did have moments like that that really, for me, turned the movie around.
I agree those scenes do work, though. The thing that bothered me about them is all of a sudden Bryce Dallas Howard becomes kind of a mute, where before you couldn't shut her up.
Right.
She's really talkative. Then all of a sudden, in the most
important
moments.
He adds a little moment where he's like, we've got to give her a reason not to say something.
And it just,
it doesn't work. It strikes you as the kind of thing that was like a first draft bedtime story that really worked for his kids. His kids loved it and had him tell it over and over again. And I just don't know if he ever really improved the logical flaws in it.
Yeah. And Misael, the big point that Misael makes is that I kept saying how, you know what, it's a fairy tale, I know, and yet it didn't work. And Misael says, yes, it is a fairy tale. And that obviously
fairy tales always work.
You know, M. Night wouldn't be so disjointed, wouldn't make such a disjointed kind of bad movie in the way it's constructed if it wasn't deliberate. And I hope I didn't give the impression that I don't agree with that. Every choice here is obviously deliberate. I totally agree that he made all of these choices deliberately to emphasize all the eccentricities and oddities of every character. The problem is, you touched on this, Sam. He's making a children's story that really is for adults and is trying to make us see the movie in a world that is our world, a real world.
And
there's war going on all over this film, and we're looking for leaders and all that stuff, and yet you then can't buy into these characters who do belong in a fairy tale. Yep. That's my take anyway.
Right.
Okay.
No, I totally
well,
agree.
Some Clerks 2 feedback here real quick, Sam. We got a voicemail from our friend Cleveland in Brooklyn.
Yep.
And I just wanted to mention this because it's worth bringing up that he said that he talked to a friend of his. He said a young teen, a black kid from the hood, those are Cleveland's words, who went and saw this film and saw it with a really diverse crowd. And Cleveland didn't know about the 8-minute ovation and apparently got it con until he listened to our show. But he was talking to his friend, and his friend said, this young teen, that he went and saw this movie with a really diverse crowd, whites, blacks, Latinos, you know, diverse crowd. They saw the movie, and at the end, everyone was laughing so hard that at the end, they stood up and applauded.
You aren't kidding me.
That's what he said.
Maybe it replicated the audience in Cannes.
Maybe so.
Who knows? But again, I think we both admitted we understood that moment. I know I saw it in the middle of an afternoon with maybe 15 other people, unfortunately. Yeah. I bet. You know, I'd love to see it with a group full of people, like a room full of people that are excited and ready to laugh. I bet. I mean, I can totally see it.
I can see it, yeah.
All right, some other feedback for Clerks 2. This one from Aaron Myers in Maryville, Tennessee, who writes, did we go to the same showing? Every aspect of the film that you guys pointed out was exactly what I was thinking. Everything from the Jackson 5 dance sequence to liking an actress that I normally don't especially care for in Rosario Dawson, you were dead on. I normally don't agree completely with everything that you say on your show for one reason or another, but this film really brought a comfortable uncomfortableness that I haven't felt in a movie theater in a long time. I have to say that I love all of Kevin Smith's movies, even Jersey Girl, and this is his most mainstream film while keeping to his roots and the storylines that surround the world he has created.
Okay, I agree with most of that.
I agree with that too, and
yeah.
I don't think we got into that in terms of like there is a moment, the great moment that makes it that's sort of impossible to talk about on a podcast, where you have an absolute feeling of being really uncomfortable and laughing your ass off when they're getting into the racial epithet.
Yes.
Questioning whether it should be a racial epithet. Uh-huh. And the customer's there. It's a wonderfully uncomfortable scene.
It is.
That's hysterical. And it seems like all the right components are working for that to work.
Well, not everyone agreed here. Brian in California, true. Maryland, I believe it says, as a massive fan of the first film, Clerks, and Chasing Amy, I was interested even if the trailers and Smith's apparent massive ego in interviews of late seemed to turn off. Well, I must declare this genuinely bad, amateurish, and rarely funny. Smith's knack for humor and his distinct lack of ability to move the camera in any way that isn't laughable is abundant. Rounded out by a soundtrack that feels stolen from 1995. Anyways, if Jersey Girl was the warning that Smith may have peaked, Clerks 2 is a screeching shout from the mountains.
Oh.
Obviously, Brian,
we completely disagree.
We saw a completely different
showing.
We don't
even hear what you're saying.
We don't
you're
hear
completely
what you're
wrong.
Saying. No. Yeah, but it's good that he mentions the soundtrack, too, because it's something we didn't mention.
It's true.
I love the soundtrack
I did too.
Of this film.
I did notice
perfectly
that
it plays songs.
Yeah,
in this film.
I mean, I did notice occasionally, like with the Smashing Pumpkins 1979. Again, a great film from 94.
And it fits perfectly in that moment.
Perfectly. It does. But it felt kind of, I don't know why, maybe it's because I'm a music snob.
Yes. That's it, Sam. Thank you.
That it seemed a little
too obvious.
A little too obvious.
Yes.
But it still works. It works really well. I totally agree. And I even like wrote off the cueing of the Jackson 5 song because I didn't realize where they were going with it. I'm like, oh, they just picked a kind of song at random to sort of be a dance song. And then we were going to have a scene with them at the top. And all of a sudden, like I said last week, it's like I rediscovered that song.
I know.
In fact, Adam, you're going to hear it. At my wedding,
at
reception next weekend.
I bet. Are you going to get out and dance? Are we going to see a whole line
the
dance?
The whole line. We're going to see the whole thing. We're going to choreograph it.
I do want to say that we played a clip from that on the show because we like that moment so much, but the clip doesn't play. What's really great about it, and there is this moment where it becomes kind of like what we saw on the Drew Carey show, if you ever kind of watched that, where it all of a sudden became an actual dance sequence. Yeah. Well, the old Kevin Smith couldn't pull that off.
Like that. Exactly.
He actually couldn't pull that off.
He got the right people involved
and
to do
here
it.
He could. So, well, totally we've works. Got some great mail bonding feedback that we're going to get to later in the show. So if you've got feedback for us, send us an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, divorce and leopard rearing, screwball style, the Screwball Comedies Marathon continues with a pair of Cary Grant films, The Awful Truth and Bringing Up Baby, plus another round of Massacre Theater and our top five drug movies.
Natural disasters make it hard to mine. Birth, big cake, steak, and wine. The rough around the cuff that make you bust a dime. They want your heart to ache and take up all your time. The broken situations that leave no resort must give way to play and sport. Don't want to think about it, don't know what to say. So sorry that you're cross. Goodbye to you today. We've got to cut the conversation, keep it clean and dry. And if they never finish, then we won't ask why. It's just a natural disaster that you've left behind. For the cuts of cake, for the steak and wine.
Australia. I figured secretly you wanted to know, so I told you. Australia.
That's your great idea.
Oh, boy, it's the latest in a long line.
Australia's no better than here.
Oh, that's all you know.
Name me one thing.
They speak English in Australia.
They do?
That's right, smart guys, so we wouldn't be foreigners.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Hallgren. Time now for Massacre Theater, brought to you this week by the world premiere of Armageddon Dance Party. More on Armageddon Dance Party in a moment, but first, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you heard coming out of the break from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, a tie-in with last week's top five male bonding movies. Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Kara Moore from right here in Chicago.
Chicago.
Congratulations, Kara. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice. And as Sam mentioned, Massacre Theater this week is sponsored by the world premiere of Armageddon Dance Party, a play written by David L. Williams. Armageddon Dance Party debuts this month at the 10th Annual New York International Fringe Festival. For tickets and information, go to thearmageddondanceparty.com. David's play, Sam, has five performances starting Sunday, August 13th and closes on Saturday, August 26th.
Check it out.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones,
Now let me hear you read your line.
All right, time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, inspired by our top five this week drug movies, which of course was inspired by our review of Miami Vice.
Right.
So I think that's all that really needs to be said. Think about drug movies, and Sam, you start it, so I'll give you the action.
And I just want to point out that you have already given me direction about how not to play this part.
That's true.
So I could be showing off my acting chops here. You are
This is a case where I'm asking
you
to
hold
too back.
Much.
Yeah, it would give away just too much. Yeah.
People are already guessing.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well, here we go. And action.
You say I'm not being straight with you?
Let's just say I want things to stay the way they are. For now, stall your deal with blank.
Have it your way, boss.
Just remember, I am the boss.
Sure, you're the boss.
You know, I told you when you started, the guys who last in this business are guys who fly straight, real low key, real quiet. The guys who want it all, the chicks and the champagne and the flash, they don't last.
And scene. Clearly a scene from that blockbuster Midwestern drug movie.
Which one's that, Sam?
Yeah, you'll have to guess.
Okay, yeah. Well, if you know what scene we just massacred, send us an email by Monday, August 7th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. Sam, I think you still gave it away, even in holding back.
I do. Can't help it. Okay. It's my DNA.
It is. It is in your DNA. A couple of quick notes before we jump into the marathon reviews here. We want to mention the podcast awards. These went up July 28th, the five finalists in the category of movies and film. And thank you to everyone who nominated us. We are, for the second year in a row, Sam, a finalist in this category, along with, let's see here, the other candidates are Cool Shite on the Tube, Firefly Talk, Geekdrome, and The Signal. So two Firefly podcasts are in the top five here, but we're in there.
We're going to split the vote. You know?
Yeah, there you go.
It's going to be like All About Even there, and we're going to launch to the top.
Pave the way for us. Yeah. But it is interesting. I mentioned this in this week's dope sheet that we sent out, which you wrote the brunt of, but I mentioned the podcast awards, that this is a case where last year we didn't even mention this once on our show or on the website, and yet you all went out there and voted for us anyway, and we got a nomination.
It was at the very dawn of podcasting.
It was,
age,
and we didn't really even think about winning it. When we lost, it was like, okay, well, we didn't promote it. I mean, that's fine. And this time around, though, hey, we wouldn't mind actually winning. Go to podcastawards.com. You can vote once a day. And if you like the show and think we're deserving, please feel free to vote for us.
And you know the Firefly people are voting every single day.
Yeah.
So the competition is fierce.
It is fierce. But you're right. It's maybe splitting the vote. It'll be interesting to see. Okay. Lastly, too, we have one quick winner to announce. We're giving away each week a copy of Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts, self-titled EP from Reverbose Records. And this week's winner, we're giving them away, Sam, too, of course, a Dope Sheet subscriber at random. And this week's winner is Jennifer Cullimore. So, Jennifer, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll get that CD sent off to you.
Here I am.
What do you want?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, go on and laugh. I know it looks ridiculous, but I'm past caring.
Oh, no, I don't mean to. What are you going to do?
What I'd be trying to do, get back to New York.
But, David, you can't go to New York dressed that way. You might be...
They're all I can find in clothes are clothes, and I'm going. I'm going back to New York if only to repair the damage that's been done since I've known you.
Okay, that's a scene from the more renowned of the two Cary Grant films we're discussing on this show, Bringing Up Baby, number 97 on the AFI list of the 100 greatest American movies. In Baby, released in 1938, and The Awful Truth, released a year earlier, we've got two very different types of screwball comedies and two very different Cary Grants. Leo McCary's Awful Truth presents a more familiar Grant, a suave playboy who is almost always in control, a little bit of a variation kind of on his notorious character.
Sure, yeah.
And Howard Hawks' version in Bringing Up Baby presents a nerdy, bumbling Grant who is in a near constant state of chaos. And of course, we'll get into the plots of these two movies more as we discuss them, but I wanted to go ahead and start with Bringing Up Baby, even though it is second chronologically. It's probably the more famous, more renowned, as I said. And I saw a comment from Dave Kerr, a capsule review in the Chicago Reader, because I was looking at what movies were playing in Chicago, and I noticed that Bringing Up Baby was on the list. So I clicked on it, and it's playing at an open-air screening. And Dave Kerr had these comments, Sam. Though it's almost impossible, try to sit back sometime and enjoy this 1938 Howard Hawks masterpiece, not only for its gags, but for the grace of its construction, the assurance of its style, and the richness of its themes. What I want to ask you, Sam, did you come away from Baby impressed by its masterful gags, graceful construction, assured style, and rich themes?
Well, I didn't have Dave Kerr telling me about the graceful construction and all the wonderful gags. Instead, I listened to the director's commentary, obviously not the director's commentary. It wasn't Howard Hawks. It was Peter Bogdanovich telling me about the graceful construction and actually doing his best Howard Hawks impersonation, literally. I have to say, even after watching the film and even after listening to the bulk of Bogdanovich's commentary, no, I was not convinced. And I have to say, I actually learned a lot about comedy. I think just in terms of perception of comedies while I was watching this. And the fact is, very simply, this movie just bored me. I just couldn't wait for it to be over. That's the awful truth. I was like, and I think of the people, all of a sudden I was thought of the people that tell me they don't think Will Ferrell is funny. And I'm like, I can totally appreciate that. I'm not saying everyone should think he's funny. I happen to think he's funny. And I'm thinking what probably particularly enrages them about watching a Will Ferrell film, if they don't like him and they're forced to watch a film of his, it's because all he's doing is being Will Ferrell, being funny. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to Will Ferrell comedy other than he and his cronies being funny. So it could be, if you don't think that's funny, it's agonizing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't think Bringing Up Baby and all the gags and the jokes and the performance, the heightened performance, Cary Grant playing this bumbling professor are funny, it's going to be awful. And I have to say, this film also, you didn't get into the plot because there really is no plot to Bring Up Baby, really. I mean, Cary Grant is a day away from getting married. He's a day away from putting together his perfect brontosaurus.
He's a paleontologist.
He's a paleontologist. And he meets Katharine Hepburn and really this rich heiress, really, who gets in his way and determines to be with him, really, and keeps his bone away from him, you know, and keeps his fiance away from him as well, in upstate New York, or in Connecticut, rather. And you know what? It's just, I was exhausted, just exhausted by this movie.
Yeah.
And an hour in, I turned and I was like, my God, is there really a lot more to this? And one of the reasons why is because this film, at any point, could be resolved plot-wise, and it's not. It's just extended and extended and extended by gag after joke after joke, and it's just, if this is your cup of tea, you're absolutely going to love it. I'm not saying everyone should have the response I did. I'm just saying, you know, I can understand why certain films are just absolutely dated. And Hawks, I love Hawks. I love Cary Grant. I even think Katharine Hepburn, I admire her performance here. I actually think she's quite charming.
Yeah.
But my God.
Well, after our disagreement last week over My Man Godfrey, our kind of heated disagreement, Sam, we're on the same page here.
Wow.
We're both going to be blaspheming one of the all-time
great comedies.
I mean, everyone adores this film. It is number 97, and I think AFI had it number 14 on their comedies list. And I'm with you. I mean, you used the term agonizing. The A word I was going for was annoying, but agonizing is better. I am really with you. I learned a lot. You said you learned a lot about comedy. I learned a lot about what I look for, I guess, in a screwball comedy. Yeah. I really expected that all these films in this marathon I would just adore, because
the other films
in screwball comedies, the other screwball comedies I've seen, I've always really enjoyed. And I thought, wow, this is all going to be just masterpieces here.
Right.
And as we learned last week, I didn't really love My Man Godfrey. And here, this was like My Man Godfrey, what I didn't like about it, just amped up to the nth degree.
Right.
And I'm right with you. I actually ended up watching this movie in like three installments because I actually got so annoyed with it that I couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
This zaniness that everyone loves about the film, how the madcap humor and the pace of it, and it just that it's just nonstop. You know what? For me, that doesn't work. I like the movies more like The Thin Man and more like The Awful Truth, we'll talk about in a little bit, where it is a little bit more, you know, there's some dynamics to it.
Right.
You've got that madcap humor, the zaniness, the screwball comedy
mixed
in with a few subtle moments, a few restrained moments, and this one doesn't have it. And I guess which in some way is why people love it. Again, because it just puts the pedal to the floor and it never stops. But you know what? I was annoyed with everybody. I was annoyed with the plot and the fact that it just kept adding on.
Yeah.
Oh, we have a leopard.
Oh, no,
we have
two leopards. Yeah.
You know, and Katharine Hepburn, she has some really great moments in this film. But on the whole, I just want to slap her. I just want to be away from her just like David does, Cary Grant. And Cary Grant, who we do love, unfortunately, watching Cary Grant here play this nerdy character, his whole character, the way he plays it, is to stoop over and to stick his neck out when he talks to you.
And
that's
yells.
His way of playing. And to yell, you're right, in this very kind of mono, you know, voice, all the same pitch.
Right.
And it's just really annoying. Everything about it, again, annoying is how I felt.
Well,
I when I got to the hour mark, I was like, oh, good, it's a screwball comedy. There's only like 30 minutes left, right?
No!
There's another hour. My brain, literally, I was overloaded by Bringing Up Baby.
In fact, I would kind of want to reenact the, if for those of you that haven't watched the film, I actually want to reenact the movie for you in a nutshell. If you could say David, go ahead, Adam.
David.
Susan. There you go. That's the whole movie right there. David, Susan, over and over. And I have to say,
talking over each other.
And again, it's great what Hawks is at. It's like, it's nonstop, and you have to admire. And listening to Bogdanovich's commentary really did help me appreciate the construction. because, again, like, it's the performances, whatever, could annoy me, but I could appreciate the construction. And it's true. Just looking at the first scene, the information he gives you about Cary Grant's character sets up the beginning and the end, the relationship with the fiance, everything. And it is. It's, and I don't want to criticize the film for its construction. You can only look at it as a fact. I think I've always been troubled by lists of great comedies because more than anything else, it's subjective.
Yeah, of course.
And so to see like a film like Bringing Up Baby, which just I just wanted to turn off, for that to be the number 10 greatest comedy of all time, whereas
whatever,
like you talk about the greatest dramas or thrillers, I could still appreciate moments in those films. Rarely are those films just going to annoy me.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, this was a surprise.
I can't wait for the feedback on this because I'm with you. And I think maybe this is something like you said, Sam, where people like Dave Kerr, maybe a critic, a respected critic, maybe you talk about this in The Dope Sheet. And I thought it was a really interesting point. Yeah. Maybe he saw it growing up.
Yeah.
He saw it when he was young. He saw it in a theater, had a great experience with it. And maybe he hasn't gone back and checked it out
since. I wonder, too. Although,
if you do,
it was funny. You know? Rent the movie and listen to Bogdanovich's commentary because it's really strange. Because he's clearly alone in a room with a microphone. And first of all, to hear somebody like alone in a room laughing at a film you're not laughing at is kind of strange. But also, he mentions the fact that like in the 60s, he did some interviews with Howard Hawks. And occasionally, he says, like, I'll reference them throughout the commentary. And he'll get to a part where he'll say, like, and I asked Hawks at the time, you know, where did the idea for this film come from? And then clearly looking at a script of his interview, he says, well, actually, this film was actually based on the relationship, the actual true relationship between John Ford and Katharine Hepburn.
That's awesome.
He impersonated Howard Hawks throughout the entire commentary with actual like verbatim.
So it was funnier than the movie.
That was funnier than the movie. Going back to like, Aguirre, Wrath of God, I said the commentary is actually makes the film more interesting. Bogdanovich.
Well, that is a great point to close this out. I mean, really, it comes down to, again, laughs. How much did you laugh at these comedies? And I laughed once, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe
once. I laughed when Katharine Hepburn was like, "When the bell rings, it will be 3:45." When the bell, I mean, there were some funny things, and like Carrie was saying too. She watched the film, and she and her friends still joke about the scene where Katharine Hepburn is like, "I was born on the side of a hill. I was born," and she because her heel breaks.
You know what? Honestly, talk about giving up my man card. You know what? The funniest part, the best part of Bringing Up Baby was for me watching Katharine Hepburn change wardrobe. Her outfits in this film are so incredible. Those dresses and the hats and everything. Just watching her change clothes is the best part of the film. For me, it was. I got to make one last point. We got to get to the awful truth. But the other thing that doesn't work about the film is in its one kind of serious moment, it gets to the end. And the end wants us to believe that David has learned something about his life.
David?
That David's learned something about who he is and that this was really the best experience of his life. The problem is if you watch this film as he's going through the experience,
you
he's
don't
never
see that
once having
not
fun.
Once. He has
never
to tell
once.
You.
Yeah. At the end, it wants us to believe it. So, okay, well, The Awful Truth, we got to spend some time on it, Sam, here. Came out a year before, and it is a film about where here we've got a more traditional Cary Grant. He's a little smoother. He's married to Irene Dunne's character. They're Jerry and Lucy Warner, and they both have suspicions about each other.
Right.
And so they say, well, if you can't trust each other, then we're going to get a divorce.
We're going to get a divorce.
So they go through a divorce process, and then it's kind of about winning each other back. And there are some shades of the Philadelphia Story here, and characters who split apart, but there's still that love. His Girl Friday, it's kind of a common theme of married couples coming back together, realizing that they still love each other. And you have that here with The Awful Truth. Did you enjoy The Awful Truth any more than Bringing Up Baby?
No.
Really?
No, I didn't. I feel like this whole show, and I dreaded coming to this recording because I was like, didn't like Miami Vice, didn't like Bringing Up Baby, and just sort of didn't like The Awful Truth. And part of it, and I hate to pick on her because she seems like a really nice woman, but Irene Dunne,
I loved
not
her.
Really.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's like she struck me as honestly somebody that's probably not even a bad actress at all, but not a comedian. I honestly spent the bulk of the film just being like, wow, where's Carol Lombard when you need her? In terms of somebody that's a truly gifted comedian, Irene Dunne seems very pleasant, but also seems uncomfortable with the truly comic moments. And I also found the entire structure of the story just kind of bitter. Like, I didn't like the fact that, you know, the whole nature of the divorce and why it happened, and the fact that the reason that really keeps them apart or together. I mean, there's not a lot of chemistry between the two of them. I think compared to the chemistry between William Powell and Carol Lombard, or you talk about William Powell and Myrna Loy in the first two films, true chemistry. There's not enough chemistry here. And the fact is, it's like they divorced and then Cary Grant spends the bulk of The Awful Truth just trying to sort of get back together with her, but not really. At any point, he could just say, let's get back together. Yeah, instead, they've got, again, I don't want to criticize.
It's not a screwball comedy.
I know it's not, but I didn't believe in those stakes, really. I mean, okay. The fact is, it's like they both hook up with some really boring people, although I don't want to write off Ralph Bellamy, who's great in this. He's really, really funny. As, you know, as the kid,
the guy from Oklahoma.
The guy from Oklahoma, the guy in oil, who becomes Irene Dunne's new beau. And uh-huh. He's very, very funny. And I just love the conviction with which he plays his part. And I think that's what I like about all of Cary Grant's performances. I admire his conviction, too, in bringing up Baby, but also here. It's just that I didn't really like the stakes so much.
Okay. Well, for me, the stakes worked here. And I liked the fact that it was something as simple as, you know what, they don't really trust each other anymore and they go their separate ways. And unlike Bringing Up Baby, which is, as I kind of said, a marching band just blaring at you for 2 hours, here you get some dynamics and you get those pauses. And there's a moment that's great where they have just come back. They meet each other after they've been away for a while. And this is really the impetus for the divorce. And she says, no one's interested in my night's adventure except Jerry. And he knows it's innocent just as well as he knows that, well, he just got back from Florida. And there's actually a pause there. I mean, there's the screwball comedy pacing to the whole movie into this scene and the way they deliver the lines. And yet after that, there's that little pause where you realize it's a great little subtle dig at him because she knows that he's been out and hasn't been in Florida and that something is up with him as well. And so whereas, again, Baby kind of lost the two main characters amidst all the chaos and these other plots and these other characters. And by the end, you've got like 20 characters in this movie, in this jail, you know, at the police station. Here, it keeps the focus really on the two main characters. And I did think that Irene Dunne and Cary Grant had great chemistry. And so like The Thin Man, watching those two characters exchange barbs, that's what I enjoyed about watching this film. And I really did laugh quite a bit at this movie, which I said is the main thing that's important. And I do love the fact, too, that really the moment, I mean, really the priceless moment of this film is just watching Cary Grant prop his feet up on a chair and get comfortable watching Dunne and Ralph Bellamy have to dance together and make fools of themselves on the dance floor.
Yeah.
Cary Grant just sits back and looks, and the way he just, the look, the smile on his face, and the way he gets comfortable knowing that he prompted this whole thing, those are the screwball comedy moments that make it all worth
it. But for me, it's just like you've got characters whose only job is to create conflict, and they don't serve any other purpose. And that's what kind of annoyed me about it. I feel like I think we saw a lot more of that in My Man Godfrey in terms of really believing, even in this heightened, crazed family, that they had real motivations and real stakes and that they were, in some sense, real characters that I could believe in. In this case where we have, you know, Alex Darcy as Armand Duval, the singing teacher, mm-hmm. it's just like his only job was to create a sense of conflict.
Right.
He wasn't interesting outside of that at all. Ralph Bellamy, who, again, is wonderful, isn't, you don't ever believe that she's going to marry this guy. And so there's no stakes there. And, you know, Cary Grant late in the film, he has a woman as well
Dixie
that he gets
Bell
hooked up
whatever.
With. And there's nothing quite there either. So again, it's just, I wasn't engaged
but
by
again,
the characters.
But again, it's all just prompting.
And I
all
wasn't
of that's
laughing.
Fair
I really
just
wasn't
to
laughing.
Prompt those comedic moments and those moments of kind of interesting affection and conflict between them. And for me, they
were. And maybe if it was Carol Lombard or Myrna Loy instead of Irene Dunne, who, again, I'm sure she's a very nice woman, but not a great comedian.
Well, I really like Dunne throughout. And you know, the sensuality, too, of their marriage worked for me. The end scene is really kind of sensual and sexy in its own way. And I liked it a lot. And I liked her timing and just her kind of brassiness throughout. Unlike Katharine Hepburn, who, like I said, has some great moments, but is just of a certain pitch the whole film, Dunne actually shows some range and some, you know, some dynamics there. So I was at least... thank God I, you know, was able to salvage this a little bit with The Awful Truth.
All right. Well, next week we'll take a vacation from the marathon, but in 2 weeks...
Couldn't come soon enough.
Right. But in 2 weeks we'll return with Preston Sturges' Sullivan's Travels.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, our top 5 drug movies. Stay with us.
I chose not to choose life. I chose something else. And the reasons? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got heroin?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that, of course, a clip from our namesake, Train Spotting. I think we're going to call this top five drug movies list the Rent Boy Memorial List, right, yeah, or Mark Renton Memorial List. Right. But before we get into that top five, we do have some feedback we want to get into, dive into the mailbag with some male bonding top fives.
That's right. We're going to start with this one from Wally, his top five male bonding movies. He's got Lord of the Rings. The relationship between Sam and Frodo represents the very best of two male friends, so much so that it is often considered very gay, as we know from Clerks 2.
Yeah.
Number four, The Sandlot. Number three, Mallrats. Number two, Terminator 2. And number one, and he was not alone, Wally, The Shawshank Redemption. How is this not on your list? He asks, on the best male bonding films ever. I don't know what I can say. This film has it all, a great friendship, a moving plot, and the last scene where Morgan Freeman jumps parole and goes searching after Tim Robbins and ultimately finds him in Mexico, words cannot describe.
Yeah, well, he certainly wasn't alone. We have this one from Mark Larson. How could either of you not include The Shawshank Redemption in your male bonding top tens? Shame on the both of you. And Dave in Washington, D.C., Shawshank Redemption, though sometimes this movie gets too much love, there is no stronger male relationship in recent film than Andy and Red. The surrounding characters, especially Brooks, invoke strong emotions themselves, but the Andy-Red relationship is the heart of the story and makes Shawshank contain the best male bonding story in film. And, of course, we did reference this in the tease going listener feedback. I agree with you.
You
Sam,
overlooked it.
You have a very good excuse. You think it's overrated.
I think it's overrated. I think it's like a good film. I feel like maybe I'm on the record as hating this film. I don't hate it. Tim Robbins just annoys
you
the
do hate him.
Hell out of me in this film. But I think it's just sort of overpraised, and so it didn't even make it.
It didn't. Into, you didn't even
not,
consider
into contention.
It. Yeah. For me, guys, I have no excuse. I just overlooked it. I'm with you. This is one of those films that I can watch and watch and watch again. I love it, and I agree it should be in the male bonding top five. So, mea culpa. I've got nothing except.
I feel like it's not the first time we've overlooked Shawshank for a top five
narration. See narration. That? We had the same exact thing happen.
The honorary Morgan
people
Freeman.
Wrote in, how could you not include Morgan
and
Freeman?
And we didn't have an excuse.
And we didn't have an excuse, you know? Okay, well, we also have this one from Kent Shelton in Denver. Really enjoyed the top five. Was surprised, however, that Breaking Away did not warrant a mention from either of you. It is certainly a great male bonding film, much more than it is a sports film. And he also mentions Jaws. As far as individual scenes in film that depict male bonding, I don't think it has ever been done better than when we saw Hooper, Quint, and Chief Brody singing Show Me the Way to Go Home in the Galley of the Orca.
Keep
the great shows coming. It is a great pick. And also, Breaking Away, we didn't get a chance to mention this because we were on a cell phone with Ed Burns during our interview, and the audio quality got kind of progressively worse as he got near the airport. But we did ask him for his top five male bonding movies, and Breaking Away was the first movie he mentioned.
Yeah.
So, a great choice.
This one is from Laura. Her top five male bonding films: Beautiful Girls, Stand By Me, Saving Private Ryan, Motorcycle Diaries, and then her number one, Master and Commander, which would also qualify, she says, as a nautical movie contender, you know, if you ever decide on that top five topic. And certainly it's not something we got to with Pirates of the Caribbean.
We may, though, get into the nautical
list.
But
it's a great pick.
It is. Motorcycle Diaries is a great choice that I think I did actually have on my list to consider. And then also Master and Commander, I may have overlooked that, but we both liked that movie a lot.
We did. I think honestly, it was on my short list. We just discussed it as a film. Films I Thought I'd Hate was on my list. And so I think I just overlooked it for that reason. But it's a great pick.
But much like the relationship in A Beautiful Mind, the Paul Bettany-Russell Crowe relationship in Master and Commander is a huge part of that, in addition to, obviously, it's just a bunch of guys on a ship. So, great choice from Laura Sanchez-Shigoya.
Yeah, I just like saying your name. So.
Okay, well, lastly here, we just wanted to mention, we did have some fun with our Friday top five early movie memories, the kind of unofficial top five, and we have received a number of great responses so far, and we will get into those on a later show. So we just wanted to acknowledge that. Thanks to everyone. Feel free to please keep sending them in. With that said, Sam, we have to get to drug movies, tying in with Miami Vice. What movies for you just missed the cut? Did you use any kind of criteria? Let's hear them.
Criteria was that it was a movie about drugs.
Great.
Okay. Quickly, a couple ties up at the top here. I had the Hollywood versus Manchester England tie, which was Hurley Burley, based on the David Rabe play with Sean Penn, Kevin Spacey. Really good film, I think.
Okay.
Fun, good performances anyway. And 24 Hour Party People, of course, Michael Winterbottom. Bob Fosse's biopic, Lenny, and also a tie with Alex Cox's Sid and Nancy. Then The Big Lebowski, of course. Anytime he's not drinking the White Russian or the Caucasian, he's, you know, smoking the J-bomb. So that had to be on there. Then I had Requiem for a Dream and Mike Mills' Thumbsucker. Our lead actors, you know, sort of
self-medicated, if not conventional drug use.
That's right.
That's a great one. Okay, my 6 through 10, the movies that just missed for me. I had my nostalgia pick on there. I actually had to put Less Than Zero. Robert Downey Jr., Andrew McCarthy, Jamie Gertz when she was hot. I like that movie. I also have Dazed and Confused.
Jamie Gertz when she was in movies.
That's true.
Yeah.
Dazed and Confused, of course,
a drug movie.
They're always smoking
pot
throughout that movie. Midnight Express has to be on the list. Right. Also, Easy Rider, another movie movie that has to be on the list. And I also put Sid and Nancy, the Alex Cox film, a really disturbing film. I also put it on my list. But let's get into the top five.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go. Sub-question, is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
All right, my number five drug movie is Gene Hackman as Popeye Doyle, The French Connection. You know, New York cops pursuing the heroin trade with The French Connection. Little needs to be said about The French Connection. No. It belongs on a top five drug movie
Actually,
list.
So little needs to be said that I just left it off my list.
Did you?
Because
okay.
It was like, it's such a no-brainer, but no, it has to be there. I'm with you on that. My number five is a film that was a little bit of a surprise for me, actually, and that's Spike Lee's The 25th Hour, and I know we disagree on it. We disagree on some of the performances in it, but I really do like this film. I like Ed Norton's performance and Brian Cox's performance, and of course, Barry Pepper, who I think is brilliant in the film in a supporting role. Philip Seymour Hoffman's good as well. But this is a movie where a guy is really kind of realizing that he's pissed his whole life away. That's really what it's about, is kind of just making those wrong choices and kind of thinking you can skate by and then it all catching up with you. And, you know, I remember reading David Edelstein at the time saying, you know, really this whole movie is kind of about a guy who's just afraid of going to prison and getting raped in prison. But you know what?
That's hard to argue that.
That's a pretty good fear.
That's a fear. You know? That's a fear you could build a movie around.
You can. And the fact is that the movie, I kind of think it actually does work with what Spike is trying to say and kind of the juxtaposition of the new New York, the post 9/11 New York with this character. I don't think he oversells it. I think it actually works as kind of just an underpinning to the story and adds that kind of extra layer to it. So I really like The 25th Hour, and I know you don't.
That's
fine. Oh, well.
Just move on. All right, my number four, continuing with my uninspired list of top five drug movies, I'm going with the movie that director Steven Soderbergh described as Nashville meets The French Connection. It's Traffic, of course. For me, it just really worked on, I think the performance, a lot of performances are really great, but it also worked on a way you walk out of that and you just leave with a frustration with the battle, the war on drugs. Really, it doesn't answer any questions. It doesn't say the questions of how to battle this thing are easily solved. And I think, you know, the script is really strong, the acting is really strong, and I just liked the handling of that problem.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. In fact, it was my number four as well. It works out well, an obvious choice, but it really is a great film, kind of a masterpiece film with the kind of multiple storylines. I love the visual look of it. Of course, Soderbergh shot it as well, and we both love Soderbergh, so it's going on my list.
All right, my number three is Doug Liman's Go, really a film that starts with, really, there's many permutations in terms of, like, who's trying to get who drugs and how, and sort of the central character, Sarah Polley's character working at the grocery store, you know, trying to score some drugs for Scott Wolf and Jay Moore, young actors, and I just like the energy of the film, and I like the characters, and you know, there's some, I just really like Polly, who we rarely get to see, but she's very good in this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I actually like her, too, as Sarah Polley.
Oh, you like her, Sarah Polley? I like her performance. I think in her American film, she goes by Polly.
Maybe she
Canadian
does.
Films, Polly.
Okay, my number three, I've got a great Christopher Walken performance in Abel Ferrara's King of New York. And really, this is a film that is kind of ridiculous because it really does try to paint this guy who's a murdering drug dealer, Christopher Walken, as a saint in a way, as a hero anyway, a man of the people trying to save New York. And it never really deals with the moral ambiguity of a guy trying to save New York through financing it with drug sales, as if he's not helping to bring down New York. But at the same time, you want to talk about badass characters.
Yeah.
More people that we have to reconsider that top five badasses list.
Did you just see this
Walken,
recently?
Yeah, I did. Christopher Walken in this list is incredible. It's also got a great visual style to it. Lawrence Fishburne is a lot of fun in it as well. So King of New York.
Good pick. All right. My number two is Gus Van Sant's Last Days. Michael Pitt playing the Kurt Cobain role here. And it really is a nice sort of elegy, really, I think, to, you know, what happens when somebody throws their life away on drugs. And I like Pitt's performance. I really like the deliberate pace of this film. And I think it really works as a very personal personal film that sort of celebrates the life of a lost life, really.
Yeah. Okay. My number two is something you mentioned in your 6 through 10, is a film you mentioned, and that is Requiem for a Dream. And I've been thinking about why I like this movie so much and why it's so high. And maybe it's because I actually can articulate why I like it. I mean, really, if we had to review this film, I don't know what I'd say about it, because other than Aronofsky's visual style and the intensity of it, this film is so disturbing. It is a film that, you know, we've included it on our one-timers top five, a movie that we're not in a hurry to see again. Our age group, Sam, people love this film. It comes up all the time in discussions. People who are in their 20s and 30s, they seem to really get into this movie, and they watch it repeatedly. And I don't get that, because I still, I own the DVD DVD. I still haven't watched it again, and I'm not in a hurry to, other than select scenes, but I love Ellen Burstyn's performance, obviously. I think she's incredible in it, and it is a film that maybe I just like it so much because I'm not in a hurry to see it again. It really was so disturbing for me.
And
it was
the visceral
such a ride.
Power. Yeah, it is a ride.
That I,
absolutely.
You know, so.
But yeah, and I think that's why I put it in the 6 or 10. It's like, yeah, it's a film I absolutely value the power of it, but you know, in terms of, I was trying to remember too, in terms of other than the character, other than really the performance of Ellen Burstyn, but you know, what was it really that I found so engaging other than the fact that you just feel like, you know, you've been
repulsed
just,
by it?
Yeah, or been just beaten by
yeah.
it. Yeah. All right, my number one, another Gus Van Sant film. I'd be surprised if it's not your number
it's
one.
It's a joint list here. Joint number one, Sam.
Drugstore Cowboy, Matt Dillon, James LeGros, and Kelly Lynch, who spend the bulk of the film robbing pharmacies to feed their drug addiction. And, you know, it doesn't so much celebrate drug addiction, certainly, but he's made a film really about drug addicts where you really enjoy the ride that you're on with these people. I mean, these people are largely likable, but it still gets at the, what addiction does to relationships. And, but it's just filled with the kind of like lived in performances mm-hmm. that Dillon, that Lynch gives LeGros. It's that performance LeGros gives.
I think it's LeGros, but okay.
Is it? I feel like there's some dispute on that,
okay.
But, all right. Well, his performance, really, I kept looking for him other films. He doesn't get a lot of work.
No,
he's a great
doesn't.
Character actor, but he's wonderful in this film. Of course, so is everyone else.
He's really good in Living in Oblivion, playing the Brad
yes,
Pitt
the Brad
kind of character.
Pitt. Yeah, you're right.
But also small role in Singles. But yeah, I'm with you. I mean, what do you say about this film? It is a film that we both, you know, have acknowledged to each other. We probably haven't seen in 10 years, but it right. does stick with us.
Yeah.
And I love everything about kind of the superstition part of it with Matt Dillon's character and not putting the hat on the bed. Those kind of great Van Zant touches. And Max Perlick in it is also very good in a small little role. But all the characters are great. Heather Graham, who
yeah,
I haven't
you're
liked
right.
in a lot of movies, I think she's good in this one. So Drugstore Cowboy, for me, it's my number one as well. Well, a movie that I think was also our top 5 directorial debuts.
That's
it was
right.
definitely high up on my list. So, all right.
All right. Well, that's our top 5. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening in wide release this weekend, the animated comedy Barnyard, the British horror film The Descent, Robin Williams and Toni Collette in The Night Listener, and the movie that Sam's been waiting for all summer but will not get
will
to
not
review.
Will not get to review.
Will Ferrell.
Unbelievable.
In Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. Sam, you won't be able to review this because you're getting married.
I'm getting married. Usually on the day we record the
yeah.
show, instead, I'll be getting,
you're
married,
getting married.
You'll be there as well.
I will
you
be at the wedding.
Guest
but
host Scott Smith.
That's
we'll
right.
Have
I'll come back the next day. Scott's going to be my date, actually, to the wedding.
That's right. That's
yeah.
so exciting.
Yeah.
Your wife is going to stay at home.
Uh-huh. No, we're coming up, and then we're going to come back on Monday. Scott Smith and I are going to
we'll
sit down.
We'll have the unofficial review at the reception.
That's
Dancing
right.
Dancing to ABC by the Jackson 5, reviewing.
We'll review it.
I wish you could be there. Everyone.
Everyone will love that. But we are going to review on our next show with Scott Smith, Talladega Nights, and share our top 5 sidekicks. And this was a list devised because, hey, John C. Reilly, let's just call it the
and
John
I'm
C.
the missing
Reilly
sidekick,
list.
Of course.
Yeah, you are the missing sidekick. Perfectly. Okay. Thanks to Enon and Touch and Go Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at tgrec.com.
Check out the Top 5 Archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on the blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Hallgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by GoDaddy.com. As a Film Spotting listener, enter code FILM3, that's FILM3, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Sam, you started?
Is that true?
Yes. Well, where was I?
There's your outtake.
That is my outtake, isn't it? Okay.